Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
We have back with us today our friend Jerry Bullard from Adams Lynch and Lofton in Grapevine. And Jerry was with us last almost 2 years ago when we had come on two times to talk about, first of all, what was going to happen, he thought, in the then current legislative session. And then we did a postmortem on what actually happened, which was kind of fun, sort of an after-action review of the ledge. Welcome back, Jerry.
Hey, thanks, Todd. Thanks, Jody. I'm always happy to jump on with you guys.
Well, we're glad to have you. It's kind of strange that our podcast has been around long enough that we can start having repeat guests, and we're now in our second legislative session.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I got to thinking, this is session 10 for me since I started doing this way back when. So, man, time flies.
And just up front, if any of our listeners are kind of new to our podcast or Texas appellate practice, Jerry is a great resource for all things legislative, both the things that are proposed that have no chance and the things that have a pretty good chance. And he does a weekly email summary kind of telling you what some of the bills are and what's going on in the process. So if you aren't subscribed, Jerry, what's a good way to get on your email list? Because it's an incredibly valuable tool.
Well, the email address, let me just give you that. Just send it to my work email address is jdb@all-lawfirm.com. It's all lowercase. And just say, hey, I want to be added, and I'll add you to it. However, if you find it on Twitter, because I post it on Twitter, or if it sometimes shows up on Facebook, there's a link you can click on there to subscribe, and it'll automatically subscribe you to that version. So there's various ways to get to me, and I'm always happy to add. It doesn't cost anything, so...
Yeah, I'm glad you haven't put it behind a paywall yet, but I feel like you ought to because you could probably make some pretty good money off of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, maybe.
One thing, you know, we kind of tend to see happen, Jerry, is during the session, you'll get on the CLE speaking circuit and be talking about bills. And I think it really happens a lot after the session's over. But, you know, because we have a biennial legislature, I think it makes a lot of sense for us to offer this sort of a little two-part series every other year. So we're really glad to have you back to talk about what we think may happen in the upcoming legislature and what's looking like it may be on the table.
I'm happy to do it. Like I said, it's something I started 20 years ago, I guess, now. And I just, you know, I don't know what it says about me, but I love doing it. And I love tracking stuff like this and keeping our bench and bar informed is kind of a public service. So I'm happy to do it.
Well, it really is a valuable and important public service because there's just so many bills filed. I mean, how many bills have been filed so far this session? And I know we're not to the cutoff day yet.
Yeah, well, this Friday, well, as we're recording it, we're 5 days away from the deadline. And through March 3rd, we were over 5,200 bills. And so we're ahead of the pace of the record number of bills filed. So we'll see what this last week holds, but there's usually, I would say, around 2,000 bills or so filed the last week of each session before a bill filing deadline. So who knows how many we're going to see? There's a lot.
How do you possibly approach those just when you've got just the sheer volume like that coming in? I mean, how do you cull through what may or may not be of interest to appellate practitioners and Texas lawyers generally?
Well, I've gotten pretty adept at using the Texas Legislature online website, and anybody can go to that website and they can track legislation by bill number or keywords. But what I typically do is each day, at the end of each day, I'll click on that website, see what's been filed. And the way I've got it set up and the way it usually is set up is that if you could look at the caption, the bill caption, which kind of summarizes what the bill is about, I get a good sense of what the bill's about just by reading that one or two line caption. And then if something piques my interest where it's obviously something related to civil justice, criminal justice, or the courts, then I'll click on the bill and I'll read it from start to finish. So, I get a sense of what the bill's about, obviously, that way. But then trying to figure out whether it's going to get traction or not, I'll look at who filed the bill, who the author is, what party they're a part of versus who's in leadership, and also the bill number. If it's a low bill number, that usually tells you it's a priority somewhere. And so there's going to be a lot of emphasis behind those bills. And so if you got the magic combination of low bill numbers, civil justice, judiciary, and the right people are sponsoring it, that's a pretty good clue that something could happen. So that's how I go about it.
Spend less time analyzing data and more time digging into the facts with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge. Powered by the largest collection of federal and state dockets, litigation analytics instantly aggregates data points to produce information such as likely timeline, outcomes, representation, and damages from which you can base your case strategy and assess potential litigation costs and resources and position yourself for success. Gain a strategic edge using data-driven insights with litigation analytics on Westlaw Edge.
Unless you've got any kind of other prefatory comments, why don't we go ahead and just kind of launch into it? We're dispensing with our usual formalities today because people who know you know what you do and maybe have heard those previous episodes with us before. And we would refer folks back to those episodes because I think one thing that they'll notice is some of the themes that we're going to talk about today are recurring from the session 2 years ago. So let's launch right into it. What do we have coming up, you think?
Well, usually before the session rolls around, there's a lot of frequently asked questions about, what's the legislature going to do? And a lot of times it centers around a topic. So if y'all recall to last session, at least for the appellate practitioner, there were several bills filed that affected the appellate courts. One of them had to do with redistricting of the courts of appeals. There was a bill filed to create a statewide court of appeals. There was a business court bill that was filed. And so leading up to this session, a lot of questions that were put to me were, are we going to see those bills again? So, of course, we all thought that we would, and that's proving to be true. So one bill that's got my interest deals with the creation of a statewide appellate court. That I forgot what the bill number was right now last session, but that one got some traction and went through the Senate, didn't get voted on the House side. But that bill has been refiled. And it's got some traction. We have Lieutenant Governor seems to like the idea, I'm told. The governor likes the idea. Certain members of the House like the idea. And so that's a bill that I'm paying attention to. It's Senate Bill 1045. There was a companion filed last session or last week, HB 3166, that we're going to be keeping tabs on. It would create what they call the 15th Court of Appeals. So we're adding another court to our appellate court system. Now, those bill numbers are kind of high. SB 1045 and HB 3166. So ordinarily I would say, well, that means it may not be as important, but it really is. And so, we'll be keeping tabs on that one. There was another business court bill that was filed, HB 19. That was filed last week. And so that's got a low number. It's got interest from all the parties that want to see it happen. So we'll be keeping tabs on that one too. There's lots to talk about for us as appellate lawyers and civil trial practitioners. So those are the two that really jumped out at me as being something we need to pay attention to.
So the movement toward the 15th Court of Appeals, that would have kind of a certain statewide exclusive jurisdiction, right?
That's right. And that one's really a repackaging of what was called last session Texas Court of Appeals, where it was going to be kind of like a mini Supreme Court. This one's going to be similar the way it's proposed, where it'd be judges elected statewide. The jurisdiction would be, like you said, Jody, it would be geared towards, dealing with suits against state government, state agencies, state officials. There are some other ones like that that would really, that creep over into that jurisdictional area. I'd have to pull the bill to remind myself exactly what that jurisdiction is. What I thought was interesting about this bill was it also added a provision that said, or it as otherwise provided by law, which pretty much says if we're going to set up this new court to be the 15th Court of Appeals to go statewide, it's not going to be limited to that jurisdiction, I don't think. As time goes on, it creates an avenue for the legislature to say, hey, we want to add this other type of cause of action to the jurisdiction of that court and make it exclusive if they want to. And that's what the business court bill that just filed has that tie in. So that's another, we can talk about that one here in a second, but that's what that 15th Court of Appeals would do, would create a statewide court, elect judges elected statewide to hear certain cases.
Sounds like maybe that might be the backdoor way of creating a business court.
Well, yeah. And that when we talk about the business court bill, that HB 19, what that bill is, it actually creates trial courts only. But it says that if the 15th Court of Appeals is created, appeals from that court are going to go to the 15th Court of Appeals.
Oh, okay. We're going to have a separate judicial system for business cases, basically.
Yes, that's what that proposal looks like.
And I'm jumping ahead a little bit. I'm sorry, Jerry.
That's okay. We're going to be all over the place, I fear, because there's so many tie-ins to the bills and other ones. And that's what, it's fascinating.
Would the 15th Court sit in Austin, or have they designated some other place for it? Do you remember?
Well, they would be based in Austin, but it could really go anywhere. They could decide to set up shop to hear a certain appeal at whatever location they decided. So they're looking at here.
And that, one of the things I thought was interesting is it's exempted from docket equalization too.
Yes.
Sometimes the bane of our existence and sometimes a good thing, I guess, depending on which court you draw on which particular case.
Yeah, that's right. And so the idea is obviously to create a specialized court to handle certain types of cases. And depending on who you ask, purpose of the creation of this court is to really extract a lot of those cases that go to the Austin Court of Appeals, those involving state agencies and administrative proceedings, those that typically would go there. They wanted to go to a court that sits statewide, since those cases have statewide implications.
I saw one of the topics was, state statute constitutionality where the attorney general is involved, which I guess it does make some sense to have maybe a statewide court deciding those issues short of the Texas Supreme Court, rather than having some conflicting interpretations among the lower courts.
Yeah. And you'll hear pros and cons about that arrangement, obviously. And so it'll be interesting to see what direction it goes, because there is interest in it, and it's on both sides, both chambers and leadership too. So.
And it's going to, I think, make life difficult for a lot of legal research and writing professors, because I remember my appellate brief in law school was to the 15th Court of Appeals. So they're going to have to rejigger that to figure out who their new, I guess the 16th Court of Appeals is about to get a bunch of appellate briefs from moot courts if that goes forward.
Well, they may want to pick a higher number, so you don't have to.
Yeah, that's true. Do we have to, is that kind of in lieu of or in addition to reorganization bills, or are some of those out there too?
Well, that was the other question that we would often hear about the possibility of reorganizing the courts of appeals, because it was somewhat of a messy process when that bill was laid out last session. And just kind of asking around, just various folks, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of political will there to reorganize the courts of appeals right now, because there's so many factors involved. Obviously, you've got, besides the political, the Republican Democrat component to it, you've got rural counties, urban counties, and what the effects of that reorganization would be for those who would want to get elected to these larger courts from the rural areas. So you kind of have that going on too. But at the same time, proposing a 15th Court of Appeals and then turn around and saying we need to reorganize the 14th, the other 14, and reduce them in number, that just doesn't look very good.
Yeah,
in terms of political optics, nor does it make a lot of sense.
Well, and there's just so many constituencies that had to be involved last time that I think kind of felt like they got left out of that process early on. I just wondered how far that was moving along.
Well, and then, like I said, we still have a week left at the time of recording this for bills to get filed. There has not been a placeholder bill filed yet, like there was last session. And just for refreshing our memories, a placeholder bill is one where someone files something just to hold it in place so they can amend that bill later. And last session, we had two bills that were filed that said essentially wanted to remove the overlapping districts, overlapping counties and several districts. So that's what the official bill was when it was filed. But because of the caption being so general about the jurisdiction of the courts of appeals, that was a bill that allowed someone to propose an amendment later on, which is what happened last session. One of those bills has not been filed yet, and I've yet to see a bill that's general enough to capture a reorganization of the courts of appeals. So, but there's still time. That can still happen.
No, that makes sense. I just kind of wondered how that was put out there this time around. Was there an interim study on appellate court jurisdiction? I feel like there was, but I may be misremembering.
Well, there was an interim study done by the House Jurisprudence and Judiciary and Civil Jurisprudence Committee, and they looked at several things, especially courts. They talked about redistricting. just in the testimony, but the report itself didn't really address it. And so it's kind of one of those things they talked about, but never really wrote about. So it was discussed, but there was never a formal report coming out of the Judiciary Committees basically saying, yeah, we think it's time to redistrict. Now, in the background, you know, there is a constitutional provision that says we're supposed to examine the Court of Appeals districts after every 10 years or after a census, and they're supposed to examine redistricting, which hasn't been done, and who knows how long. So, I mean, that's out there, but I don't know that anybody's really going to file a bill that's going to deal with this session. And then to add to it, I'm sorry for kind of rambling on here.
No, this is great.
There are two lawsuits that were filed, one in Collin County, one in the Eastern District of Texas up in the Sherman Division, where there's been a Voting Rights Act lawsuit that was filed challenging the way the courts of appeals are districted. And it was filed by an individual who I understand to be a Republican voter who basically said, wait a minute, you know, the courts of appeals have shifted, the districts have changed, the demographics have changed. Now, all of a sudden, the person I'm voting for, my vote doesn't mean anything because the Dallas Court of Appeals is pretty much Democrat dominated. So we've got those two lawsuits that were filed, and there was some school of thought that maybe the filing of those lawsuits may trigger the legislators to do something. But once again, I don't know that that's going to happen. But those two cases are pending, by the way. They're in the early stages. So just interesting stuff.
It is interesting.
We can switch over. I think the parting thought as far as these types of bills is they continue to come up session after session. And I know there's within the judiciary itself, I know there's a lot of opposition to those particular, not only appellate redistricting, but the creation of additional courts. And so this is not going to be the last that we'll hear about this, more than likely. Even if these bills don't go through, there'll continue to be more discussion about them. So we'll look forward to following these issues with you, Jerry, as long as they go on.
Yeah, and they'll go on for a while. So even if it doesn't get addressed this session, it's going to come up again, like you said.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's kind of switch over to business courts, which it sounds like maybe a little bit related to ultimately where the 15th Court of Appeals is headed.
Yeah, that's one that let's back up a little bit just to kind of set the table. The Lieutenant Governor, Dan Patrick, he had set forth some priorities early on in the session, legislative priorities, one of which is the business courts. Matter of fact, when it gets filed in the Senate, we already know it's going to be Senate Bill 27, so it's got a low number. We also knew that on the House side, it was a priority. Speaker Phelan last week had said, we have several priorities on the House. One of them is going to be the business court. And that got filed the same day he announced that as a priority, which is HB 19. We had the Judicial Council make a recommendation that there be a pilot business court established that would be done by rule. So that's a little different than this business court bill. But there was talk about that happening as well. And I've been told the governor likes the idea of the business court concept. And so you've got key senators, you got key state reps, you got the speaker, you got everyone saying business courts is a good idea. So we knew that was coming. And sure enough, it did. And it's in the form of HB 19. Now, what HB 19 does is it's pretty similar to the other business court bills that have been filed in previous sessions. We were talking about the statewide court of appeals being composed of judges elected statewide. This bill deals with trial courts only. Okay. The last few bills that we had seen created a trial court, business trial court, and also a business court of appeals. Well, the business court of appeals is specifically carved out of this one. So we're only talking about trial courts. But what's interesting about this one is you still have judges who are appointed to sit as the business trial court judges. They'd be appointed by the governor. And they would be appointed for 2-year terms. And so you would have 7 judges who could, you know, who could go all wherever there was a need for a business court dispute, they could go. And they would try those cases. And then when they finished up, then it would go to this 15th Court of Appeals that we were talking about a while ago, if that court is created. But there's a provision in the bill that says if the 15th Court of Appeals isn't created, then the appeals of those business court decisions would go to the, you know, the Court of Appeals where that court is sitting when it issues its decision. So there's a carve out for a specific appellate court here, but there is an appellate route that's provided for in the bill. So the jurisdictional amounts is similar to what it was last time around. And there's a very long list. I wouldn't want to recite them all for you, but I mean, it centers around business disputes, you know, shareholder disputes, disputes between businesses that are over a certain amount of money. I think $10 million is a number that's been floated around being the amount in dispute. And it exclusively eliminates things like PI cases, family code cases, things like that. So here we are talking about it again. It's a little different concept, but everybody seems to want it to happen. And I say everybody up at the higher levels. The question is going to be is, will you get enough legislators to support it?
You know, one of the things that I thought was interesting about this bill is it only provides for the appointment of 7 judges, which when you consider the expanse of the state, doesn't seem like a whole lot, given the kind of broad jurisdiction. Is the thought that it's just sort of a test balloon case, or is it intended to have expansion, or is it just not clear at this point?
I think the million-dollar question is, how many cases are we talking about? Talking about creating a new court system with specific areas of jurisdiction, but we're not exactly sure how many cases there are out there. And the last I checked, the Office of Court Administration usually maintains statistics about, but they don't have this level of detail. So to figure out how many cases we're talking about, we're going to have a lot of guesstimates. Someone's going to have to try and figure out, what that number looks like, but we don't know. We don't know how many cases we're talking about. So is this going to be a busy court, or is it going to be, or what? We just don't know that yet. And that's what a lot of people are asking. We need some data before we move forward with the whole new system, with new judges, and we got to fund it. How are you going to pay for it? But no, that's a great question. I don't know exactly what that looks like.
Yeah, with only 7, it seems like pretty quickly those 7 judges could bite off more than they could chew. Yeah,
it's going to sink or swim pretty fast, because when you look at the list, that there's a lot of things that could fall under some of those categories. And $10 million at issue, I think, was one of the jurisdictional thresholds for it. But, does that mean $10 million alleged? Because I could see a lot of cases where people allege huge damages to get into a business court that may or may not ultimately end up getting to that. I don't know. It presents a lot of interesting things that ought to keep appellate lawyers busy if it ends up getting passed.
Reminds me a little bit of, removal to federal court. And so, I mean, what would be the process for moving cases back and forth between the ordinary civil dockets and the business courts? I mean, would there be a removal process, or how would that work?
Well, there is some component in this bill where you could either file it there initially, or the parties could agree to remove it later on. And it looks like you'd have to have some sort of removal process if someone tries to file it in a court of a regular jurisdiction, for lack of a better word. Someone thinks it needs to be in the business court. There is a removal process. We don't know what that looks like yet. Obviously, somebody would have to pass some rules to deal with it, but it was certainly something that would have to be addressed and flushed out. And as I say, the devil's in the details,
Yeah. So absolutely.
And we're going to see, that the normal trial lawyer groups are going to chime in on this issue, pro and con. In the past, we've had most of the groups oppose it, whether it's defense side or plaintiff side, or whether it's Texabota is one of the organizations that's composed of both plaintiffs and defense lawyers who had opposed it. We had the business law section and the business law foundation. The section has to get permission to take positions, but the foundation doesn't. Of course, they've been pushing this bill for a while. So you've got those little groups who think it's a good idea, but you have a lot who think it's not a great idea. And this is not one that goes along party lines typically either.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com.
Is the idea to sort of model like the chancery process that Delaware has to kind of have a streamlined court for business disputes?
Well, I think that's the idea. But if you say chancery court to the proponents of it now, they'll say, no, that's a different deal. Chancery court, court of equity, there's no juries or anything like that. That's a different deal is what they'll tell you. So they'll stay away from that terminology. But yeah, I mean, I think that's what it's intended to look like. And what's interesting about this bill that wasn't in a previous one is that there's an opinion writing component to this one. So these courts will be required to write, opinions about their decision, unless it's well-developed case law or something they may not have to write an opinion on. So, this is kind of a hybrid mini appellate court in some ways.
But is that even, I know there's seven judges appointed statewide, but they're still sitting as single judges, right?
Yes. That's the plan. I mean, it looks like the Supreme Court could appoint like associate judges or visiting judges if they needed some help, or there's a mechanism to provide those judges resources to help them handle cases. But
especially, you know, opinion writing.
Yeah. See, I mean, they're going to have to, yeah, you have to have staff attorneys, and you're going to have to staff this thing. And so when you look at how many cases we're talking about, which no one really knows, and you're talking about a new trial court system with judges, it's going to require staff and facilities, I guess. Maybe in some counties you'll have to have, I mean, I don't know what that looks like yet. There's a lot of hidden cost in this. It'll be interesting to see what the fiscal note will be once they're required to put one of those together to figure out what the price tag would be and how you're going to pay for it. So,
and then both with this one and the 15th Court of Appeals, I assume we probably will need constitutional amendments too.
Well, yeah, that's up for debate too. With respect to the business court, there are those who think we don't need a constitutional amendment, that the Supreme Court, or I'm sorry, that the governor can have authority to appoint some of these judges. I mean, that's good. There's no constitutional amendment proposed yet, but there has been one filed for the 15th Court of Appeals. The author of that bill in the House filed a proposed resolution for the voters to vote on the 15th Court, but they haven't done that for business yet.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Well, does that about cover it for the court, the potential court changes, Jerry?
Well, yeah, those are the major changes in the court structure. There's a couple of interesting bills that I've found. Well, one of them was self-explanatory, I think, based on the Dobbs opinion leak. You know, there was a bill to create a criminal offense for the unauthorized disclosure of judicial opinions, Senate Bill 372. You know, State Affairs has already voted on that bill and voted it out of committee. So, I mean, it's already on the track to go to the Senate. And, you know, there's a companion in the House, but I don't know that one's going to have any pushback at all.
That doesn't seem like a particularly controversial thing to do. I'm frankly kind of surprised we didn't have some criminal statute that covered that already.
Well, I guess I don't know who I heard speak on it, but I guess there could have been a penal code provision that deals with how you handle government property. And that could have provided some sort of a vehicle to prosecute someone for disclosing opinions, but it wasn't clear. This specifically deals with that topic. So that's one that's already well on its way, I think, to approval. I was trying to think, you know, there's one about prohibiting per curiam opinions.
Yeah, that's an interesting one.
And I'm not sure what the driver is there. The senator is Mays Middleton out of Galveston. You know, he was in the House last session, pretty conservative guy. And so, which makes me wonder if there was an opinion he didn't agree with. He would like to know who wrote it. Wouldn't we all like to know who writes PCs, right? We all want to know that, especially if we're on the losing side. But, you know, those just got referred to their respective committees. So I'm not sure exactly, you know, how much traction that was going to get. But it's one of those that I'm kind of going, I wonder what's behind that. So I'm doing some digging because I'm curious.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting issue, and one that never would have come to my mind as something that needed to be addressed, that just can't have any PC opinions. You've got to have an authoring judge's name on everything.
So that's one. And there's a compensation bill to give our judges pay raise.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. Do we have a sense of how much traction that one has? Because it's been a while, but not that long in Texas terms since they had the last pay raise go through.
Yeah, I think 2013, 2014, there may have been a bump that was kind of a cost of living adjustment bump, if I remember right. But the last really solid pay raises when I got started doing this was back in 04 or 05. So everyone, I think, agrees, both sides of the aisle. I think everyone thinks the judges need to be paid more. Their compensation is, I forgot what the numbers are. I should have looked it up before we got on. But I mean, if you look at the ranking of states, you know, we're towards the bottom, especially in the most populous states. So I think everybody agrees that's a good idea. Everyone, when I say everyone, you know, both sides of the aisle, both chambers. But when it comes down to nut cutting, as they say, you know, a lot of times it just kind of falls by the wayside. And the reason for that has always been, at least that's what they say publicly, is that, well, as long as the salaries of a district judge determine what the legislative pension is going to be, then the legislators don't want to be given the appearance that they're voting themselves a bump in their pension by approving, you know, a pay raise for the judges all the way down to the district court level. Now, this time around, Representative Leach in the House has filed a bill that would de-link that. That would basically set a salary for the district judge at, I think it's $140,000 base salary, And so that's what the number would be until it gets changed, but it would take it away from this, take away that political roadblock. But to answer your original question, I'm sorry for being long-winded, that everybody thinks it's a good idea. I think there's a good push for it. I think everybody would like to see it happen, whether it does or not.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and that's another one that is desperately needed, because I know we've had a lot of very good judges leave the bench in Texas because of financial pressures and issues. So it could help retain and recruit some great judges.
I totally agree with that. And that's the arguments that we'll hear from those who are advocating for it, which is pretty much everybody when you come right down to it, in terms of thinking it's a good idea. Now, there are some political overtones to some of this, as you might expect, especially since over the last few years, there have been some areas, some counties where their dockets have not been moving fast enough for the legislature to be pleased with. And so there may be some who think, well, you know, we don't want to give pay raises to judges who aren't working. At least that's the perception we'll hear.
So let's punish the rest of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Punish all the hardworking judges too, while you're at it.
Yeah. And so those overtones are there too, but I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what happens there. And, the other one I thought was interesting real quick is this. There's a bill filed, a couple of bills that deal with the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court changing to where it could basically overrule a statutory interpretation by the Court of Criminal Appeals.
I was just looking at those. I thought, we've got to talk about this.
Yeah. And so you guys probably know, but I don't know how many of your listeners will know, that it was a few months ago where the Court of Criminal Appeals had issued a decision that basically found unconstitutional the Attorney General stepping in to prosecute election cases, election fraud cases. And the issue was whether or not they had the authority to do that, or if that was authority solely given to district attorneys. Although I think, if I remember right, the district attorney could basically ask the Attorney General to step in to help, but the Attorney General didn't have original jurisdiction to do it on its own. And so based upon that decision, there were several who didn't like that, the way that came down. So these bills were filed to deal with that.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. And it sort of creates a supervisory role for the Texas Supreme Court over the Court of Criminal Appeals, which historically has not been something that they have ever wanted or intended to use. And I almost wonder how much it would actually get used, but I guess we'll see.
Yeah. And that's one of those, I'm not sure how many cases have come down to where the Court of Appeals decided that something was unconstitutional and the Supreme Court didn't like it, or someone thought the Supreme Court should chime in. But anyway, that's one that's got political overtones to it, obviously.
Right. And it makes you question, well, why isn't there just a legislative fix to this? You know, if there was some issue that somebody didn't like, rather than give the Supreme Court effectively some jurisdiction over the Court of Criminal Appeals, wouldn't it be better to just fix whatever you think the problem is legislatively, not by this blanket sort of arrangement that's being suggested?
That's the way it's supposed to work, right?
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. Powers.
And we see this at all levels of government. Now, there are some bills that have been filed, you know, to deal with those sorts of issues, to give authority to the AG to handle these cases. I don't know what that bill number is top of mind. But there is an attempt to do that too. But this is obviously looking down the road at other situations.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting one. I saw that there's also a push to raise the judicial retirement age, which is currently 75. Maybe plus a couple of years, depending on where you fall in your term, up to what, 79?
Yes. Now, that bill was filed after the bill and I forgot who filed that. I think it was Representative Vassute had filed the bill to eliminate the mandatory retirement age altogether. And there's various theories about why they did that. Sometimes it's somebody has a judge that they think's doing a great job and doesn't want them to have to time out. So they may think it's a good idea to remove that age limitation entirely. But then not too long after that, I think there was a bill filed in the House and in the Senate, companion bills raising that age from 75 to 79. Senator Hinojosa filed that in the Senate, and he's a Democrat, respected senator. He takes positions that are probably, you know, contrary to what his party would like him to take sometimes. So he has a bipartisan approach to a lot of things. So the fact that he filed that resolution, it would have to be a resolution, not a bill, a Senate constitutional amendment, makes me think there may be some traction there to be gained. And on the House side, you know, there's a companion resolution filed there. So that's another one of those. I'm not sure how many judges that affects. I don't know if it's a good idea or bad idea. I mean, it seems to me if you have really good judges who know what they're doing, you want them to hang around as long as possible. But there are those who think maybe after a certain time, it's time to go do something else and let somebody else make a decision, you know?
I wonder, being tied to age is kind of tricky because the effect is essentially there are going to be some judges who are going to have to retire in the middle of their term. And so I wonder if another solution would be, you know, 75 or after completion of the term in which they turn 75. That just seems too practical, though.
Yeah. Todd, you're not thinking like a legislator.
Yeah. Well, you know, right now it is. And this change in the Constitution was, I forgot how many years ago, maybe in 2010, 2013. I forgot when it was. But it used to be a hard stop. 75, you were done. And then it was amended to where if you turn 75 within the first, if it's a 6-year term, within the first 4 years, you can finish out the 4 years of your term. But if it's after that, you're done. There was, you know, there's a blend there where you can almost like you're grandfathered in for a period of time. So, but yeah, I don't know the answer to the question, Todd. Like I said, I know some judges who are in that age range who are sharp as tack, and sharp as a tack, we need to hang on to them, you know. But there are those who probably need to go do something else. Sometimes you got to nudge, right?
Well, time will tell, I guess, if that gets any traction. We shall see.
But as far as the court system and the judges, I mean, those are the main bills and resolutions that jump out at me. I don't know if y'all saw anything in what I've been tracking.
I have one.
I do. I have another one too, but go ahead first.
Oh, okay. I have one that's very practical. It's this House Bill 525, the delivery of court orders through the electronic filing system. You know, you guys have probably seen this in your own practices. I've seen it multiple times where e-filing has been mandatory in Texas for more than a decade. But yet sometimes our judges and their staffs don't notify the parties when an order's been signed. And so in some courts, the only way that one can count on getting notice of a particular court order is just by constantly checking the docket online, which is just an awfully impractical thing. And now this varies a lot county to county. Like, for example, in Travis County, one thing that the district judges decided to do is that they were just going to e-file all their orders. And that takes care of the problem, right? Because it goes through the mandatory, or the e-filing, e-service system, and everybody who is on that list gets notification of whatever the case event is. And so that seems like a great solution, but for whatever reason, some judges don't want to adopt it. Some district clerks and court staffs don't want to adopt it. But it looks like what this bill would do is would require any statutory county court, district court, or appellate court to do exactly what Travis County is already doing, which is to send their orders through the e-filing system. So is there any more story that you're aware of, Jerry, to this than just trying to rectify that gap?
Yeah, I don't know what the driver is. It's filed by Representative Vassut. And like I said, this is his second session as a legislator. And so I'm not sure if it's just someone got a hold of him and said, hey, we need a bill to fix this, or if there's something else driving it at a higher level. But yeah, I mean, that is a problem. And I'm surprised to see how big of a problem it's been where you have courts who just don't want to send out their orders, you know, or whatever reason. Do I have to come get, whether you rule for me or against me, let me see what you did. You know, I'm not sure how widespread that problem is, or, you know, it seems like it's an easy fix. Just do it, right? I'm not sure what the roadblock is.
It's like a pretty easy fix. And unfortunately, the consequence to the parties can be just dramatic, right? I mean, you miss a final judgment, you miss time-sensitive deadline, and you know, you're stuck with whatever the remedies are that are maybe available to you for overcoming that. But what if the time's run, you know, and you're left without a remedy? And that's not the way our system is supposed to work. So,
and those of us who practice in Travis County or Tarrant County, I'm not running into that problem in Tarrant County, at least not that I can recall. But, you know, so the counties, the more populated areas, maybe it's not a big problem there, and maybe the rural areas, and maybe that's the issue. I don't know. You start getting into somebody else's territory, they don't like that as much. So I don't know. That's a good question about what's driving it and what's the likelihood of success that it passes. I just don't know. And then the other one I was going to bring up was HB 2384, deals with basically judicial qualifications, judicial training. Representative Leach filed that bill on the House side. I suspect there'll be a Senate companion at some point. But really all that's going to do is, if passed, it would require judges to have some sort of proof of continuing education. I mean, most judges get CLE anyway. But there, this would be a requirement that would force our judges to do that. Even if you're going to be on the ballot, you know, there's got to be some demonstration that you know what you're going to be judging. You know, you have some competency in the areas of what you're going to be practicing. There's an interesting component to this bill that there would be a proposal where, you know, attorneys could get certified in judicial administration if they're going to run for judge. So they'd be able to say, hey, look, I'm board certified in judicial administration. I want to be your judge. My opponent, you know, about just barely over the finish line qualifications wise, and they don't have the experience I have. And there's lots of good things you could do with that if you're a judge. But I'm told the bill that's filed is a placeholder. They're looking to tweak it, add to, change. So, you know, I wouldn't spend a lot of time looking at the details of what's in this bill because it could change. But the main thing is that there is a push, which we've always tried to do, is to establish some qualifications for those who are going to be hearing our cases. And I think, I'm not sure who's on working it on the Senate side. I don't know if they've decided yet who would carry it. But this one has some potential to get some traction too. Something to watch.
I see one more I'd like to mention, but Jody, I don't want to jump ahead of you if you've got something.
I had three that kind of seemed like some interesting practical ones that I wanted to address. One of them is a bill that would require courts of appeals to essentially write a mini opinion in a permissive appeal case if they denied, explaining specifically why they aren't taking the case, which is kind of an interesting debate that the Texas Supreme Court has had internally in some opinions recently. And so this is kind of one of those areas where you actually see the legislature taking up something based on what the Supreme Court has said. And I have no idea if it'll go anywhere, but I just thought that was kind of interesting to tell courts of appeals you need to say a little bit more.
Yeah, Representative Smithy out of Amarillo, John Smithy, filed that bill. And I'm not sure, once again, I'm not sure what's behind it. You had mentioned the Supreme Court opinions that kind of deal with some of those topics. That may have been the driver for at least getting a bill filed. But yeah, sometimes we all want to know why they deny something. Everybody, permissive appeal, if the parties think it's a good idea, the trial court thinks it's a good idea, but the court of appeals says, no, we're not interested. Why? Now, if you're going to force them to write an opinion on that, then you're adding some more workload to their docket, which, you know, talking about another issue we haven't really talked about. But if your concern is moving cases and disposing a case of the court of appeals, and you're having issues keeping your good staff attorneys and they're not compensated the way they ought to be, our workload is what it is, but we can't make bricks without straw. And so this is something where you're adding more to their plate. So,
sure. I just thought that was kind of an interesting. Another one that I think makes a lot of sense is to give parties the option of kind of creating their own joint appendix for an appeal rather than a formal clerk's record, which I think in a lot of cases could save a lot of money and time.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like a pretty common sense one to me.
That's the one that I was going to flag. And I tend to agree with that. What it looks like maybe it might do if it were to go through was make at least the clerk's record part of the appellate record a lot more like a mandamus record. Although I note that they're going to have to change the terminology because calling it an appendix when you've got briefing rules that require an appendix is going to just be confusing. So maybe they could adopt something like what the federal courts do and call it record excerpts or something like that instead of an appendix. Yeah, to the extent anybody's listening and wants my suggestions on how to amend this bill, you know, there you go.
Yeah, and that's one of those bills too that it makes practical sense too, because I mean, when you have a clerk's record, you have the pleadings are filed with the trial court. It's all there. So why are we having to pay for preparation of a record and pay for the copies of those documents that everybody can see? So, I mean, I'm sure there's a cost savings associated with this, too. Of course, we all know, yeah, there are large clerk's records sometimes, but, you know, the reporter's record is going to be the one that's a lot of times is going to have the biggest price tag on it. But no, this is one of those bills I was keeping an eye on, too. Representative Julie Johnson out of Dallas filed it. She's vice chair of the Judiciary Committee and on the House side. So
let me toss in another couple more thoughts on this. So, you know, one way to get around this problem, and it's directly tied to the problem of courts not filing their orders. You know, we've got this database here in Texas now called Research Texas, and it is very, very useful. But one of the things, one of the side effects of courts not filing their orders is that orders don't show up in that database. So it's tied directly to the e-filing system. So anytime a party files something, that document automatically gets loaded into this database. And if the courts would do the same, then the orders would be as well, right? And I know that one of the long-term ideas supporting that database is that it could wind up being truly sort of PACER-like. And if that were to be the case, then it would streamline the preparation of clerk's records so greatly, because you could just rely on what Research Texas, and maybe there's a, you know, click to download all, or, you know, whatever you need to do to streamline that. But that's a big gaping hole in that system, is because the court's not putting their orders in the e-filing system.
Yeah. There's a good point. I've not really thought about that. You know, the relationship between this bill and the issue about not having orders showing up there. But yeah,
I mean, this may be a solution. I just want to point out, you know, a lot of these things are interrelated. So we're not really here to necessarily talk about the bills we agree or don't agree with. But I mean, I think this is at least a good thought to explore. But if other things that we've got in process can be sorted out, it might not be necessary.
And then I guess the last one that I had is just sort of an issue that's always interesting to me, is to limit the automatic stay under the anti-SLAPP statute. You know, in those cases, if you file an appeal of an anti-SLAPP denial in Texas, it automatically stays everything going on in the trial court, which makes sense given what the aims of that statute are. The problem is, if you have a case where the trial court has found either the TCPA doesn't apply, or that the anti-SLAPP motion itself was frivolous or filed solely for the purposes of delay, that person can still appeal and still stay the entire trial during the pendency of the appeal, or everything, not just the trial, the entire court proceedings. And this bill would exempt from the stay cases in which the trial court determined that something was frivolous or filed solely for delay, or that the TCPA didn't apply, or that the TCPA motion was untimely filed, which I think fixes something that was a bit of a problem that maybe was an unintended consequence.
Yeah, and I've not spent a lot of time looking at the TCPA cases to see how many cases this would impact. What caught my attention was that Senator Hughes filed the Senate version, Jeff Leach filed the House version. Of course, Leach was the lead legislator on the TCPA revisions a couple of sessions ago, and Hughes carried that same bill a few sessions ago in the Senate. So if you were to call architects of a particular bill, it would be these two gentlemen, and they're filing this one. So, which tells me someone has told them that's a problem. They see the problem, and that would increase the chances of that fix occurring.
Well, I mean, I can tell you I've seen it in cases I've been involved in, and it is very frustrating, because you have someone file an anti-SLAPP motion. You not only defeat it, but the court determines that it's frivolous, and then they file an appeal, which is, of course, their right, but then it ends up staying the trial court proceedings completely during the pendency of that appeal, just for the Court of Appeals to potentially say, yeah, we agree it's frivolous. And I think that that is something that the framers of this statute probably didn't realize was going to happen. And so I think that this is a very common sense fix to that. So I'll be interested to see if this gets traction and moves forward.
Yeah, it seems like we have maybe fewer proposed amendments to the TCPA than we've had in some recent years. At least ones that have made it to your radar screen, Jerry, but the ones that are there, including Senate Bill 896, House Bill 2781, which we just discussed, and the other one that you've got listed, HB 527, exempting legal malpractice cases from the scope of the TCPA, those seem to be potentially really solid amendments to refine that statute in a way that's consistent with our usual understandings of the way the law is supposed to work. After, you know, that statute was just so far afield, it seemed like, for so long, it does seem like the amendments from a couple of sessions ago have really kind of tapered it back, have had, I think, the intended effect.
Oh, absolutely. I think most folks have been pleased with the effect that the amendments had a few sessions ago, but obviously there are still holes that lawyers are going to figure out that exist, or loopholes that need to be dealt with. And I mean, that type of statute's always going to be tinkered with, I think, at least in my mind, because there's always going to be something that we don't know about as technology changes, as people change how they opine on what others do, how good a quality they're. So yeah, this is going to be a work in progress, I think, that statute. But
well, Jerry, this has been a really good discussion. And of course, we were hoping and expecting that we would have a good discussion about what's going on in the legislature here on the front end. So we'll look forward to having you back when the dust settles on the current session. And I don't know, maybe it's too early to tell, but you know, last time around we had a whole lot of special sessions come about as well. I guess maybe that's as a parting thought. Are we thinking that we may be headed the same direction this time?
Well, you know, and I hope not. Because we had sessions going into what, October?
Yeah, it went long. And, it felt like I can't remember, but it sure seemed like a long time. Yeah.
And one of them had to do with the quorum break that basically shut down the first one.
Oh, that's right.
But the issues there dealt with election, you know, changes election law and a lot of hot button social topics that they're out there. I'm sure. I just don't know if it's that level where someone's going to derail a session or a group is going to derail what happens there where specials would be needed. But yeah, we'll see. Some of these emergency items and some of these priorities may become important enough that somebody wants to talk about them in a special if they can't get it done in the regular. Remember, the only bill that has to be passed each session is the budget. So, you know, if they can get the budget done, and, you know, that takes a lot of pressure off of lots of people to call a special. So.
Well, Jerry, thanks for being with us again today, and we'll look forward to having you back in a few months.
Oh, look forward to it. I appreciate it.
And if you're listening and you haven't subscribed to Jerry's newsletter and you're interested, please do.
And we'll drop links in the show notes to the episodes from 2 years ago, the previous session. Definitely want to refer folks to those to hear more about Jerry and his practice and how he got where he is. And we sure appreciate you, Jerry, for everything you do to keep track of legislation for Texas lawyers.
Oh, I'm happy to do it. And I'm not just a legislative update guy, but...
practice law.
It is why I'm here. Like I said, I enjoy doing it. It's a form of public service. So happy to provide that.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.